It is fascinating to watch these powerful characters struggle toward consensus, often reluctantly, to write a flawed but living and breathing document that could evolve with the nation. And now? The summer of 1787.
Chapter 1. It started at Mount Vernon. March 1785. Snow was falling outside as George Washington mulled over the problem with his neighbor, George Mason. A fire in the west parlor, where the Washingtons entertained guests, pushed back the night chill. Both men favored sweet Madeira wine in the evening, and Mount Vernon's house slaves made sure they had everything they wanted. Dedicated farmers, the men talked easily of the cold weather that would delay spring planting, and of the grafts Mason recently sent for Mount Vernon's cherry trees. On the other side of the mansion, the wide lawn sloped down to the Potomac, which curved gracefully between Maryland and Virginia on its journey from the western mountains. The river was the problem. The two states were fighting over it, and their argument was a symptom of the deepening crisis of the new United States. Washington, 7 years younger than his guest, had earned an honest fatigue during a day on horseback, supervising work around his plantation. Mason, though, knew only the jangling irritation that follows a day of impatient waiting. They had been friends for almost 40 years, spending days and nights in each other's homes. Together they had hunted for deer, talked politics, hosted dancing schools, shared farming strategies, and schemed to develop the Potomac as a center of trade. Both were local leaders, serving as vestrymen for Truro Parish and trustees of the city of Alexandria. Each, in his own way, had led the rebellion against Great Britain. In 1774, Washington had presided over the county convention that adopted the Fairfax Resolves, which Mason had drafted in that same parlor at Mount Vernon. Mason's aggressive resolves proclaimed that imposing British laws on Americans without their consent violated the privileges of a free people and the natural rights of mankind. Washington went on to personify the American Revolution with his moral and military leadership, while Mason played a more local role through Virginia's General Assembly. By different paths, they each had reached a stage in life where he had many admirers, not so many friends. Each now described himself as retired. The firelight exaggerated the contrasts between them. Known to crack walnuts with a single large hand, the strongly built Washington had thrived on outdoor living and battlefield dangers. At 53, he retained the grace and power of a superb horseman and dancer. But it was something from the inside that made him the master of every room he entered. Certainly he was a Virginia gentleman of courtesy and integrity, but so were others. Equally, he had his flaws, including being addicted to gambling, avid in the pursuit of wealth, a most horrid swearer and blasphemer, and unrelentingly ambitious. Washington's force came from the antagonistic qualities he blended. His gift of taciturnity radiated dignity and calm, yet he simultaneously implied, in the words of one admirer, "passions almost too mighty for man." No one who saw Washington's rage ever forgot it. The combination of steely discipline and powerful drive generated a charisma so compelling that, by one account, every king in Europe would look like a valet de chambre by his side. The leader of a successful rebellion against the world's greatest empire, he was the first citizen of the American continent.